Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Sorry, guys, I messed up yesterday, didn't I? I accidentally posted the day before's podcast, so you had the same podcast 2 days in a row. I just clicked the wrong file when I went to upload the episode and didn't notice. And I've just sat down now to do the podcast and loaded up the page and realized a bunch of people are saying, hey, you forgot, oh, you've done it wrong episode. So thanks to everyone who let me know, and sorry that it took me 22 hours to read those messages and realize that I'd made a mistake. So yeah, it was like the full cycle of the day. I'm sitting down to do the next episode now, and it's not until I sit down to do the next episode that I realize I messed up the last one. But I've just published yesterday's episode, the correct one, so that's up. By the time you hear this, that new one's up, and you can find it on the subreddit, yesterday's episode, part 2, chapter 13. Apologies for that. So we're discussing now chapter 13. Happy chapter 13 discussion day, everybody. I know it's a big event on the calendar year. Many happy returns to you and your family on chapter 13 day. And let's just keep the good times rolling. Levin is doing his farmy things. Colpick is my new favourite character, and Levin is overseeing the sowing of his land for the next harvest. Those were the discussion prompts that I left for you guys. Not very good discussion prompts, I apologise for that. I guess I was a bit uninspired. I couldn't think of anything, so I left you with some shitty discussion prompts. But hey, all they are really is to get the conversation rolling, and they did that. Swim said the mama fish. He said, farmy things. We are beginning our education of 19th century Russian farming practices and reforms, and Tolstoy's opinion about them. Per the internet, Leo Tolstoy would frequently stop work on Anna Karenina to walk with the peasants in the fields. In later years, the aristocratic author even styled himself as a farmer, dressing in the linen tunic traditionally worn by Russian peasants. He argued that everyone ought to work the land and believed that the ills of society built on serf labour should be cured through a return to subsistence agriculture. Isn't that just the funniest thing, right? These guys were so posh that his big claim to fame was that for a little while he wore linen and did yard work, like worked on a farm. Oh, man. What a low level to stoop to plant a tree now and then, or to till a farm thing. I don't know how farms work, but don't you find that funny that, like, that was such a thing for him to do? Right? I worked on a farm once. It was fun. A few farms I've worked on. Will they write that in my biography? Probably not. Will I go down in history as the guy that worked on a farm once, even though he didn't really have to? Stupid. I am Norwegian, said... Sorry, I shouldn't say that's stupid, but it's just... Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird that that's, like, one of the things that he did, this great man? Who cares? You did some farm work. I am Norwegian, said, I wonder if there's some intentional irony in Levin, having just finished an agricultural treatise specifically aimed to include the worker and his disposition, being completely unable to get his employees to do anything on time. But even with all of that, he recovers his disposition and just grows happier as he goes. I don't know why, but there's something really nice and comforting about reading about the tediums of 19th century farm life. Hopefully we stick with Levin for a while. Of course, says Mummifish, of course, he is attempting to implement the treaty's prospects and having it not work. Says, Swim, said the Mummifishy. Bless his heart. Before we all get dewy-eyed about Levin's farm life, let's remember he is a wealthy estate owner, basically playing gentleman farmer, not a tenant subsistence farmer, barely eking a living to feed his family. Irish potato famine, anyone? For Matt Carker said, this chapter felt like an explanation of the poem Stopping by the Woods on a Snowy Evening. Robert Frost. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep. That poem was in The Sopranos recently. Levin and his steward, what can we say about them, says Tekrific. To me, they represent two sorts of religious attitudes in this chapter. The steward, with his fatalistic and superstitious religiosity that stultifies and pacifies. Levin, with a more active attitude towards his fellow men. In his mind, he defends them against the steward's traducements. If they act wrongly, it's because of the steward's bad stewardship, so we could have a discussion on neutral leadership versus appointed leadership, but I think we all get to the gist of it. I just wish Levin had been a little more assertive and maybe considered removing the obstacle, but that's my modern mind talking. Levin tries to accommodate all those who live on his lands, whether they be his beloved cows or his servants, but that steward spells trouble, mark my words. I am Norwegian, and I think today's podcast episode is the same as yesterday's. It was. It is, says Tekrific. I've sent him a DM, but I think he already went to bed. After all, it's 3 a.m. down under. We just have to wait a couple of hours for it. The wait is terribly long, says Nifty Rific. Yeah, it was a bit more than a couple of hours, because today I had a couch day. So I didn't go on Reddit all day until now. I had a couch day, and you're probably thinking, "Ah, oh, you were on the couch all day. That's nice." But no, I had my cousin's couch in my house. He said, "You know, use my couch if you want." So I did. He had it in storage. I needed a couch. But recently, his housemate moved out, and he needed his couch back, which meant I had to go get my uncle's van, which is about half an hour away, then pick up a couch, which my mum had in storage, bring that to my house, put the other couch in the van, drive that to my cousin's house, unload that couch, drive the van back, get my car, drive back home. It was about 4 hours of driving and two couch moves, and I'm knackered. All that just to rearrange, just to move two couches, but those two couches were about an hour and a half away from each other, and there was vans to get and all the rest. Anyway, that was my couch day. Yay, what a fun time. I'm really tired because, you know, couch day. And that means tomorrow I might have to have another couch day of the other variety. Chapter 14 of the book that we're reading, Anna Karenina, goes a bit like this. As Levin, in the highest spirits, was nearing the house, he heard the sound of a tinkling bell approaching the main entrance. Why, that must be someone from the station, he thought. They would just have had time to get here from the Moscow train. Who is it? Can it be Brother Nicholas? He did say, perhaps I'll go to the watering place, or perhaps I'll come to you. For a moment he felt frightened and disturbed, lest his brother's presence should destroy the happy frame of mind that the spring had aroused in him. But he was ashamed of that feeling, and immediately, as it were, opened out his spiritual arms and with tender joy expected, and now hoped with his whole soul, that it was his brother. He touched up his horse, and having passed the acacia trees, saw a hired three-horse sledge coming from the station, and in it a gentleman in a fur coat. It was not his brother. Oh, if only it's some nice fellow with whom one can have a talk, he thought. Ah, he cried, joyfully lifting both arms. Here's a welcome guest. Well, I am glad to see you, he exclaimed, recognizing Oblonsky. I shall know now for certain whether she is married or when she will be, thought Levin. And on this lovely day he felt that the memory of her did not hurt him at all. You did not expect me, eh? Said Oblonsky, getting out of the sledge with mud on his nose, cheek and eyebrows, but beaming with cheerfulness and health. I have come to see you, that's one thing, he said, embracing and kissing Levin, to get some shooting, that's two, and to sell the Ergushevo forest, that's three. That's grand, and what a spring we are having. How did you manage to get here in a sledge? It would have been worse still on wheels, Konstantin Dmitrich, said the driver, whom Levin knew. Well, "I'm very, very glad to see you," said Levin with a sincere smile, joyful as a child's. He showed his guest into the spare room, where Oblonsky's things, his bag, a gun in a case, and a satchel with cigars were also brought, and leaving him to wash and change, Levin went to the office to give orders about the ploughing and the clover. Agatha Mikhailovna, always much concerned about the honour of the house, met him in the hall with questions about dinner. "Do just as you please, only be quick," he said, and went out to see the steward. When he returned, Oblonsky, fresh and clean, with hair brushed and face radiant with smiles, was just coming out of his room, and they went upstairs together. "How glad I am to have come to you. Now I shall be able to understand what the mysteries you perpetrate here consist of. But seriously, I envy you. What a house, and everything so splendid, so light, so gay," said Oblonsky, forgetting that it was not always spring and bright weather there, as on that day. "And your nurse, quite charming. A pretty housemaid with a little apron would be preferable, but with your severe and monastic style, this one is more suitable." Oblonsky had much interesting news to tell, and one item of special interest to Levin was that his brother, Sergius Ivanovich, intended to come and stay in the country with him that summer. Not a word did Oblonsky say about Kitty, or about any of the Sherbetskys. He only delivered greetings from his wife. Levin was grateful to him for his delicacy, and he was very glad of his visit. As usual, during his solitude, a mass of thoughts and feelings he could not express to those around had collected in his mind, and now he poured out to Oblonsky the poetic joy of spring, his failures, his plans concerning the estate, his thoughts and remarks about the books he had read, and especially the idea of his own book, the basis of which, though he did not notice it himself, was a criticism of all previous works on agriculture. Oblonsky, always pleasant and quick at understanding everything from a hint, was specially pleasant on this visit. There was a new trait in him which Levin noticed and was flattered by, a kind of respect and a sort of tenderness towards him. The efforts of Agatha Mikhailovna and the cook to make the dinner specially nice resulted only in both the hungry friends sitting down to a snack and having to appease their hunger with hors d'oeuvres and bread, of bread and butter, smoked goose, and pickled mushrooms, and in Levin's ordering the soup to be served without waiting for the pastries with which the cook intended to astonish the visitor. But Oblonsky, though used to very different dinners, found everything delicious, the herb beer, the bread and butter, and especially the smoked goose and pickled mushrooms, the nettle soup and the fowl with melted butter sauce, the Crimean white wine. Everything was delicious, everything was excellent. "Splendid, splendid," he said, lighting a thick cigarette after the joint. "I seem to have come to you as one lands from a noisy steamer onto a peaceful shore. So you maintain that the labourer should be studied as one of the factors which should decide the choice of agricultural methods? You know, I am quite an outsider in these matters, but I should think this theory and its application ought to influence the labourer too." "Yes, but wait a bit, I am not talking about political economy, but about the science of agriculture. It should resemble the natural sciences and should examine the existing phenomena, including the labourer, with his economic and ethnographic." At that moment, Agatha Mikhailovna came in with some jam. "Ah, Agatha Mikhailovna," said Oblonsky, kissing the tips of his plump fingers, "what smoked goose you have, what herb brandy. But what do you think, Constantine? Is it not time?" he added. Levin glanced out of the window at the sun, which was setting behind the bare trees of the forest. High time, Kuzma. Tell them to harness the trap," he said, and ran downstairs. Oblonsky went down and himself, carefully, took the canvas cover off the varnished case, opened it, and set to work to put together his valuable gun, which was of the newest type. Kuzma, already scenting a substantial tip, did not leave Oblonsky for a moment. He put on his stockings and his boots for him, and Oblonsky willingly allowed him to do so. "Constantine, please leave word that if the dealer Ryabinin comes, I told him to come here today, they should ask him in and let him wait." "Are you selling the forest to Ryabinin?" "Yes. Do you know him?" "Of course I know him. I have had dealings with him, positively and finally." Oblonsky laughed positively and finally were the dealer's favourite words. Yes, he does speak very funnily. She knows where the master is going, he added, patting Laska, who was whining and jumping around Levin, now licking his hand, now his boots and his gun. The trap was standing at the door when they went out. I told them to harness, though it is not far. But if you like, we can walk. No, let us drive, said Oblonsky, stepping up into the trap. The trap was a long vehicle, something like a jaunting car, but with four wheels, says the footnote. He sat down, wrapped a rug around his legs, and lit a cigar. How is it you don't smoke? A cigar is such a, not exactly a pleasure, but the crown and sign of pleasure. Ah, this is life. How delightful. This is how I should like to live. But who prevents you? Levin remarked, smiling. No, you are a lucky fellow. You have got all you are fond of. You like horses, you have them. Hounds, you have them. Shooting, you get it. Farming, you get it too. Perhaps it is because I am glad of what I get, and don't grieve about what I haven't, said Levin, thinking of Kitty. Oblonsky understood and looked at him, but said nothing. Levin was grateful to Oblonsky because, with his usual tact, noticing that Levin was afraid of talking about the Shcherbatskys, he avoided mentioning them, but now Levin wanted to find out about the matter that tormented him, and yet feared to speak of it. Well, and how are your affairs? He asked, recollecting how wrong it was of him to be thinking only of his own concerns. Oblonsky's eyes began to glitter merrily. But you don't admit that one may want a roll while one gets regular rations. You consider it a crime, and I don't believe in life without love, he answered, understanding Levin's question in his own way. How can I help it? I'm made that way. And really, so little harm is done to anyone, and one gets so much pleasure. Is there anything new, then? Inquired Levin. There is. Well, you know Ossian's type of woman, such as one sees in a dream. Well, there are such women in reality, and these women are terrible. Women, you see, is an object of such a kind that... Woman, you see, is an object of such a kind that study is as much as you will... Sorry, let me go again. Woman, you see, is an object of such a kind that... Study it as much as you will, it is always quite new. In that case, better not study them. Oh no, some mathematician has said pleasure lies not in discovering truth, but in seeking it. Levin listened in silence, but in spite of all his efforts, he could not enter into his friend's soul and understand his feeling, nor the delight of studying women of that kind. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Have your say about that one over at Reddit. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.